The world called, and a poet answered.
Back when the earth was new and heaven just a whisper. Back when the names of things hadn't had time to stick. Back when the smallest breezes melted summer into autumn. When all the poplars quivered sweetly in rank and file. The world called, and I answered.
That's poet Rita Dove. We talk with her about her collected poems, 1974 to 2004, and hear her read from it. It's published by W.W. Norton. Then we honor our Thanksgiving tradition of airing Marge Bruchek's True Story of Thanksgiving and a reading of my story, The Food Philosoph. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Rita Dove is one of America's most celebrated poets, the youngest person, first woman, and first African American to serve as U.S. Poet Laureate from 1993 to 1995. She's the author of a prolific body of work. Now she's brought together the first 30 years of her poetry into the volume Collected Poems 1974 to 2004. It includes her most famous work, Thomas and Beulah, a collection of poems loosely based on the lives of her maternal grandparents, for which she received the Pulitzer Prize in 1987. I called up Rita Dove to talk about the collection and about her experience of looking back over three decades and reviewing her evolution as a poet. Well, Rita Dove, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
So this book of collected poems, 1974 to 2004, I first just want to ask you, why did you stop at 2004?
Well, it seemed to me that there was a wonderful kind of symmetry between with these numbers from 74 to 2004. It represented a 30-year span, which to, I think, many people is kind of representative of a working period in one's life, but also because my at 2004 I began working on another book, which I don't know if it's poetry or if it's a novel in poems or you know, well, what exactly it was, and it just knocked things off balance to put that book in there. To me, the collected poems represents a significant period in my life, in a certain way, my germination and growth as a writer. And I didn't want to say that this is the sum total of my work. I have lots more waiting, so a new beginning is going to happen after this.
Oh, that's great. Now, that book that you mentioned, was that Sonata Melodica that came out in 2009?
Yes, that is the one.
I see, yes.
Yeah.
So now in the process of collecting these poems over that period of 30 years, what were you looking for?
I was actually asked by my editor if I would consider putting together collected poems, and we discussed whether it should be, you know, whether I should add new poems to it, and I said, no, I think that this is, I want maybe upcoming writers and lovers of literature to see this is the work, this is what I became. And so actually I was adamant about the fact that I wanted to include all of the poems that were published in the books. My first book came out in 1980, but the first publication that I had that actually made it into that book happened in 1974. So I said, this is the beginning of the public life of this particular poet of me, and I wanted to include everything, even the poems that maybe would make me kind of go, ooh, you know, I wish I could put that one back away. But I thought that's part of it. It's part of the education of a writer that you go and you have false starts and you go in a certain direction and you make a few mistakes and you keep going. So that was my idea behind it.
And did you feel tempted to tune any of them up or change them in any way?
I was tempted to tune them up and change them, but I did not. I, long ago, I don't know if it's stubbornness or what, but I had made this vow to myself that once a poem had appeared in a book, I was not going to change it. I would not go back and fiddle on the poems. It was the best I could do at that moment, and now the thing is to continue. So I just decided, no, I will not. And in going through the poems and looking at the arc of the work, because I tend not to look back. I'm not someone who's going to sit there and dwell on what I did before. I was struck by the paths that I took sometimes, and I was struck by the fearlessness of some of the early poems and where they went and the surrealistic quality of them. Mm. But I was tempted sometimes to say, oh, goodness, no, 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 that just sounds old hat. And I thought, no, when I was, you know, 30, when I was 29, it was not old hat. It may feel old hat to me now, but that's that would be a kind of a, I think it would be kind of a dishonoring of what youth is and what one's vision is when one is a youth, to alter them now to make them seem wiser.
Well, but fearlessness and surrealism, those are two very interesting words, especially juxtaposed to each other. Could you say a little bit more about that quality in your early work?
A lot of times in my early work, there existed a kind of a dream landscape, which I think was often my parents' backyard. It was a, you know, place where I walked out of the house. So I was walking out into a world, but it was a contained world, and it was a safe world because it was the back door, not the front door. But in this landscape, all sorts of strange things happened. I mean, people appeared who were dead and cried, and tears of, you know, whatever. Lots of strange things happened. Elephants appeared and walked across the horizon. And I think that that's the surrealistic part. The bold part, I think, was the fact that I dared to even put elephants in the backyard in Akron, Ohio. But I also believe that it's part of those wild, strange dreams you have when you're an adolescent. At least I did when I was a teenager. And the world was a very... The future was a very scary but place I wanted to get to, you know? And so those kind of daydreams and night dreams, which of course are also mixed up with desire and sexual longings that you don't understand, turned into images which were often fantastical but represented danger, faraway lands, you know, and at the same time, you know, unimaginable joy. So that combination was there.
Yeah, and they really come out, although actually I'm looking at a poem that references that time but was written much later, Maple Valley Branch Library, 1967, when you were, I guess, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it because libraries were my haunt, and I think I've been a bibliophile since I was 4 years old and first discovered books and wrote them. I think my mother did the right thing, and basically she wrote down the books I dictated to her, and that's what taught me how to read, because I wanted to read what I wrote.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is just a wonderful poem. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about it.
I'd be happy to. I love libraries. They're my refuge and my salvation. And even now I visit branch libraries, particularly branch libraries, right? You know, where there's a neighborhood represented. Mm-hmm. I'll visit them in any city that I'm in, and just I walk through the door and I feel at home. The branch library that I talk about in this poem, Maple Valley Branch Library, was really about five blocks away from my home, and this was a place where I could go in and go to any part of the world, any sphere of knowledge, and find something out and do it for free. Now, of course, today we all have internet and stuff like that, but there's something very special about going into a building that is dedicated to that kind of discovery. Mm. And I thought this, I had fallen to a pot of honey. This is, you know, you walk in here and I could just, sometimes I would go and I would just pick a corner, you know, without even saying I want to look for poetry or I want to look for this. I would just go into the far left-hand corner and discover that I was in geology and say, okay, fine, I'll look that up too. And there was just so much to know. And that, I think, was absolutely part and parcel of the reason why I became a writer. I loved these books. I read every book I could get a hand on. It didn't matter, you know, what genre it was. And I began to write my own stories. I started with stories, but then I also started pretty soon writing poems as well. And it just seemed natural to want to... I was in conversation with these writers. It's like they wrote something, I wanted to write something like that, or my answer to that. And a lot of times I would put a little black girl into the stories because she wasn't there in the other one, so there she came.
And, you know, there's a poem very soon after that in this wonderful collection, Collected Poems, 1974-2004, of your poems, Rita Dove, that I plan to put into the birthday card of my now 13-year-old granddaughter when she turns 14. It's called Testimonial.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that poem.
Oh, well, that's such a wonderful thought. Testimonial was, in a certain way, my response to all the... People would write ars poeticas and tell, you know, what they were going to, you know, what their theory of poetry was. And all I had was a feeling of what I wanted to learn and what I wanted to, a hunger, I guess you could say, for the world and what it had to offer. By the time I wrote this poem, also I had been in a certain way called to the plate, if that makes any sense. I had gotten a Pulitzer, I had become poet laureate, and for a shy little girl who really thought that the best thing in the world would be to hide in the corner of the library and read books all my life, to suddenly be stepping out into a public sphere like that and speaking was terrifying. And yet I also remembered that little girl who was so grateful for all those people who did exactly that. So the poem Testimony is really about that moment where you realize that you have something to offer to the world and you have actually no choice if you want to be happy within yourself but to follow it.
Mm. Would you be willing to read it?
I'd be happy to. Testimonial. Back when the earth was new and heaven just a whisper. Back when the names of things hadn't had time to stick. Back when the smallest breezes melted summer into autumn, when all the poplars quivered sweetly in rank and file. The world called, and I answered. Each glance ignited to a gaze. I caught my breath and called that life, swooned between spoonfuls of lemon sorbet. I was pirouette and flourish. I was filigree and flame. How could I count my blessings when I didn't know their names? Back when everything was still to come, luck leaked out everywhere. I gave my promise to the world, and the world followed me here.
Mm, I just love that. And it also just so captures the... You know, what a young girl is like, pirouette and flourish, filigree and flame. There's just wonderful images.
Thank you.
Now, as you said, you received the Pulitzer. You received that for Thomas and Beulah. That was a collection of poems that was based on the lives of your maternal grandparents. So tell us a little bit about them and why you decided to write a poem cycle about them.
Well, my maternal grandparents were very ordinary people, but extraordinary people in the sense that they lived a life that was honest and true, and also sought to raise us to face the future. Of course, I didn't know any of that at the time, But when my grandfather died when I was young, and I was asked to take the weekend duty. People who were in the family were staying with my grandmother so that she wouldn't be alone. And since I was too young to go out dating, they said you can have the weekend duty. So I would spend the night with her on Friday night and Saturday night. And though I had often spent time with my grandmother, this was a time when we were really very close, and she would tell me stories about my grandfather, and she told me many stories about his life before he became a grandfather. So he had this really full and amazing life. He'd been on a song and dance kind of duo and traveled up and down the Mississippi, and all of this I did not know. I mean, I was just entering my teens, and I had not realized that my grandfather was anything other than my grandfather. And so that feeling of both amazement and delight to hear these stories, and also a kind of a shame, a contrition that I had not thought to imagine him in that way, stayed with me for, I think, really the rest of my life. And so I began to ask my grandmother also stories about her life. Now, all of that happened, of course, way before I became a poet, and it was only after I had finished writing the poems that comprised my second book, Museum, that I thought I could feel my grandfather wanting to say something. And so I decided to write about his life, write about the life that I did not know, but that I wanted to know, and hope that in writing it, I would get to know what it was like to be a young black man in 1920, coming up from the South on the riverboats and ending up in Akron, Ohio. And I was trying to write him into being so that I could understand how he became the gentle and wonderful and patient grandfather that I knew. And so I started writing poems about that. What happened was that about six poems in, when I thought that I had written a nice little neat cycle of poems that dealt with him as a young man, a poem appeared that was from my grandmother. I didn't realize it at first. And in fact, it is included in my second book. And then only after the book came out that I think, this is my grandmother saying, hey, I'm in this story too. You just can't ignore me. And, you know, and that's when I realized I had an entire book, which was frankly terrifying, because at that time, many American writers, poets, were writing lyrics, short lyrics, and the narrative, like the Robert Frost kind of narrative, was really kind of looked down on. People said, those are really just stories. And so I thought, if I write these poems and about not about heroes, not about traumas, not about any of that, but about ordinary people who are black, but give them humanity and detail, and still it tells a story, it's just going to be smashed, you know, lambasted by the press. But I had no choice. I wanted to. It was my act of love, and I loved writing that book. And then I printed, you know, we published it, and I thought, oh, well, now let them come. And so it was a complete and absolute surprise to get the phone call that it had gotten a Pulitzer.
Wow. And did it also do what you had hoped it would do, and that is bring a greater understanding of your actual grandparents?
Yes, because I felt that there had been such a, in the effort to be heard at all, many African-American writers had to resort to shouting, basically. And so after the 60s and the Black Arts Movement, which was absolutely, I think, essential to get some attention paid to black writers, I felt that, well, you know, there's a whole other life. There are many, 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 you know, lives of African Americans which are different, which are not from either coast, which are not urban, which are complicated, as complicated and flawed and lovely as mainstream depictions of you know, just Anglo-Saxon characters. Mm-hmm. So this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to write and bring their lives into that kind of detailed and complex sphere.
And you also did that in your earlier poems, at least the first poems in this book are very much caught up with the historical themes, particularly of slavery, and also from a very personal point of view. And I do see what you mean by some of the, surrealistic quality, perhaps. I'm looking at one poem called The Slave's Critique of Practical Reason. Of practical reason, as opposed to, Kant's critique of pure reason. So tell us about this poem.
Oh, wow. There's a whole group of poems, as you mentioned, which deal with slavery, and they were inspired, prompted by reading the slave narratives that often the abolitionists would take down these narratives and then distribute in a way so that people could realize what the horrors of slavery were. These narratives were often very, very dry and contained because the abolitionists also did not want to make people afraid of rage or extreme emotion in the slaves that they were being asked to save. So when this poem, however, is spoken by a slave who is a little bit, who's breaking that mold, and I did choose to riff on Kant just a little bit to say that, is just to say, the philosophy isn't just for the hallowed halls of European reason and culture, but that this slave also has his own way of looking at life. And the slave in this one is talking about cotton and how his life is comprised of picking this cotton, and life goes on and on and on. And so it is sassy and in a certain way very devastating.
And then fast forwarding, I'm sure, quite a few years to a poem I will ask you to read because it's short enough to do that. Mm-hmm. And I just love, it's so simple and sheer. And it's Rosa, about Rosa Parks. It's on page 334.
Thank you.
And, it just came to me. I mean, this is, to me, this poem is so surprising. It's almost like a haiku.
Mm-hmm.
It's so pure and short and utterly penetrating. I just love it. So,
oh, thank you.
If you wouldn't mind reading that one.
Absolutely. Rosa. How she sat there, the time right inside a place so wrong it was ready. That trim name with its dream of a bench to rest on. Her sensible coat. Doing nothing was the doing, the clean flame of her gaze carved by a camera flash. How she stood up when they bent down to retrieve her purse. That courtesy.
Would you like to say something about that?
Well, I wrestled with this poem for quite a while. It was, as you say, I wanted it to be very short and kind of pure and without any kind of, I wanted it to do its own explaining because I also felt that Rosa Parks' act of sitting on that bus had a certain, you could say, haiku-like or zen-like quality to it. She sat there, they rested her, she was calm. And I thought that any kind of histrionics would muddy the absolutely glorious, light that action gave off. And so that was what I was working for. And in fact, when I was writing it, this poem used to be in quatrains. It was in four-line stanzas. There was always another line in there. And right before you know, right before publication, I was going through the proofs, and I looked, and I was still, you know, I said, this is not right. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, you have to take off the last line of every stanza was, in a certain way, a kind of a moral, and it was wrong. It was just, it was inserting my own personality in the poem. And so I took it out. I said, each one of these lines has to go, and it was the right thing to do. I don't know what those lines are.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad I had the courage to ask that question. And now I'm going to ask another one, which I hope makes some sense. I'm saying it because I read something that you wrote. You said we tend to be so bombarded with information, we move so quickly, that there's a tendency to treat everything on the surface level and process things quickly, and that that is antithetical to the kind of openness and perception you have to be receptive to poetry. So I'm going to ask you, in this day and age, what is poetry for?
Your question does make sense. I think we're all making sense of it as our apprehension of information and emotion keeps changing because of social media and things like that. I find that poetry is for giving us a moment of reflection, but also of courage. But it goes beyond that. You see, because I had thought that when Facebook and things like that came out, that a resurgence in poetry would occur because people were indeed reading and almost testifying and journaling in Facebook. But it has not really happened in the way that I imagined, because actually these kind of social media platforms have become also a place where you get bombarded with information. There is no selection in the choice of one's emotions often. So, but what poetry does, I think, is lift us out of our own, I don't want to say petty, but our own self-referential emotions, and helps us identify with someone else's or with some other kind of emotion that brings us in connection with a larger humanity. And that is enormously empowering, calming, and at the same time it can be, give one a sense of urgency and a sense of, well, what I said, empowering. It does enable you to go out. It gives you the strength to go on. How does it do that? I think it does it because language is one of the rare attributes that human beings have that many creatures do not have, and that we, through language, we use it to be able to communicate not only on a daily basis, but we can use it to try to access all the speechless parts in us, all of the things that really have, there's no word for it. And that's what poetry does. It takes language and says, I'm saying this, I'm writing this, but because of the music of it, because of the sound, because of the white space, because of the pauses, you are now breathing with me, you know, breathing with the poem, and you realize that all the depths are being sounded, you know, that we can't put into words. And poetry does that. I think the best poetry does it in a way that changes our lives.
Well, Rita Dove, it has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about your newest book, The Collected Poems, 1974 to 2004. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure, Francesca.
Rita Dove. Find links to some of the poems in her Collected Poems, 1974 to 2004, at writersvoice.net. Next up, we celebrate a feast with the food philosophe. Then we hear once again the real story of Thanksgiving, as told by Native American storyteller Marge Brushack. Stay tuned after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanksgiving is a day for feasting with friends and family. One of the most memorable feasts I ever attended happened when I was living in southern France back in 2001. The French, of course, don't celebrate Thanksgiving, but there are always plenty of other occasions to celebrate with good food and wine. The feast in question was held in honor of the winter solstice at the home of my good friends Michel and his wife, who I call Magali in the story. They live in the ancient town of Apt, in a villa with a view of the town and the Luberon mountain range above it. The food was divine, the wine likewise, and the company convivial, and I ended up learning a profound lesson about the French art of living. I wrote up the experience in the story The Food Philosophe, or Food Philosopher, part of a longer memoir of my sojourn in Provence. I read a long excerpt from the story here, joined at the end by former Writer's Voice co-host Daisy Mathias, who plays the part of Magali. Please forgive my less-than-perfect French accent when I speak in the voice of Michel. It echoes perfectly in my mind, but alas, not so much on the tongue. I had arrived at Michel and Magali's house in Op 2 days ago, but my hosts had had little time for me. Magali had been preparing the elaborate decorations. Michel, a professional chef who cooked for private clients in the region, had spent much of the time at the stove or the chopping block, obsessed, like an alchemist in his study. I had hovered on the margin like an anthropologist, observing native rituals. He was a man of many sides and a checkered past. He didn't fit easily into any categories. For one, he'd spent close to a decade in prison during his youth. The details were never really clear, but it had something to do with the underworld gangs in Marseille. He would have looked the part, too, were it not for his warmth and ebullient nature. He had a street tough's body, all barreled and bandy-legged, and his temper could be fierce. The tenaciousness of his grudges was legendary. The one time I crossed him, it took a good deal of bowing and scraping on my part before he let me back into his good graces. Assiduous watering of the flower of friendship with viticultural gifts didn't hurt either. But it was worth it. Michel has one of those hearts so capacious that it stretches its membrane to an overly fragile extent and can become all too easily pierced.
You are the one for me, for me, for me, formidable. You are my love, very, 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 very tall.
The day of the feast, the guests assembled around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The first to arrive was a wealthy couple that ran a local chambre d'hôte. The husband, a red-faced, voluble man, was retired from the plumbing fixtures trade. Within minutes of his entrance, he had already boasted that of every 3 bidets in France, one of them was his. His wife, a stylish woman with a nervous, squinting tick and clenched jaw, amused the company with her acerbic, witty patter. When the guests had all arrived, we sat down at our designated places. The company broke out of the starter line with champagne and canapés, then settled in for the long stretch. First, the entree, a traditional cream tart, this one of leek. It was followed by a simple salad seasoned with a perfect vinaigrette. Then came the meat dish, bouffard de marinière du Rhône, that is, beef marinated for 3 days and simmered in wine. I understood the marinière du Rhône, a kind of pun with marinated and sailors of the Rhône, but the word bouffard escaped me. Later I tried to find it in my French dictionary, but the closest match I could come up with was bouffer, to guzzle or feed like an animal, a description, I suppose, of the kind of behavior the dish inspired, at least in me. Then the cheese course, camembert oozing its arterial poison, and some locally made goat cheese, runny with age and topped with Herbe de Provence. The desserts followed, note the plural, butter cookies à la maison, chocolate tubes filled with Grand Marnier, apple compote, and homemade sugared almonds. The meal was topped off by coffee, followed by liqueur as a digestive tonic. After the successful conclusion of the meal allowed him to relax, Michel stood in front of the hearth, sipping his coffee. An expression of deep satisfaction wreathed his face. I joined him as he reflected on the event. "Do you know how it was all done?" he asked me, raising his bushy eyebrows in a rhetorical flourish as we toasted our backs at the fireplace, espresso cups in hand. I shook my head no. "It is a combination of the book, I never invent a recipe," he paused to underscore the interjection, stubby finger raised, "time and love. And of all these, the last is the most important." I always loved it when Michel regaled me with his philosophical observations. His views percolated in a pungent stew of anarchism, quasi-Buddhism, and evangelical Christianity, a combination that never ceased to intrigue me with its unexpected and always strong flavors. "Tell me more," I prompted him. "It is a pleasure to give, to share with others," he said as if it were self-evident. He paused and then continued. "But there is something else, the hidden part." "What's that?" "Ego." His beetle brows flew up to punctuate the remark. "Oh, yes," I concurred, although I wasn't sure where he was going. "There's always ego." Of course," he drawled archly. "I am no different than the others." We each took the glass of digestive tonic that someone handed us in passing. "When you start to cook for people that you don't really like all that much," Michel resumed, "you say, 'Aha! I'm going to show them.'" He seemed to be leading in the direction of a moral message, but I couldn't imagine what that might be. "What does that do to your cooking?" I asked him. "It deteriorates it. I am, in fact, trying to punish the customer. My sentiment is, I'm going to show this jerk. But the jerk is me." I chewed his comment over. He waited for me to digest it. "You're saying there's a spiritual lesson here about egotism?" I ventured finally. "Yes," he answered. "Well, it is not just egotism. More precisely, it is a lack of love." He thought for a moment. "Of course, you cannot love everyone. If you had to love all your guests, being a professional chef could get complicated. Balance was surely being called for here, a scaling back of spiritual expectations. But you can cook for people you don't love without this idea of showing them, punishing them with your expertise, as it were, can't you?" I asked. "Yes, but only after you have understood this phenomenon. When you've learned a little humilité." Humility is a virtue. Gluttony is a sin. Paying my sinner's dues, I finally succumbed to the surfeit of food and drink. Soon after my talk with Michel, the force of gravity propelled me to the living room couch, pinning me supine by the weight of my stomach. Once there, it was a long time before I could bend sufficiently to attain the requisite angle to get up. While resting there, I mulled over Michel's comments. I wondered which religious tradition was reflected in his thinking about humility. It seemed more Buddhist than Christian, or maybe it came out of the place where all spiritual traditions meet, the place where long years of discipline and practice dissolve the ego with the enlightenment that mastery brings. Foodism, like Buddhism, is just one of many pathways to nirvana. Buddhism says that life is suffering, and comprehension of that truth is the prerequisite to true happiness. I have no dispute with this teaching, as it counsels the wisdom of acceptance, but is it not as true that life is pleasure and happiness reposes in its enjoyment? As long as the pleasure hurts nothing and no one,
and particularly when it feeds the soul as well as the senses. The meal Michelle and Magali shared with me and the other guests was Epicurean, not in the self-indulgent, gluttonous sense of the term today, but in the spirit of Epicurus himself, the enjoyment of simple pleasures shared with friends. Michelle himself had a profound interest in the spiritual dimensions of food. He called it the philosophie d'alimentation. One morning, several months after our winter feast, Michelle, Magali, and I were breakfasting on some chewy fresh rolls from the market and Magali's homemade mulberry jam as the spring birds sang their little hearts out in the olive grove next to the patio. Michelle took up the theme again. "You are what you eat," he stated with an air of inviting questions and comments. "You mean biologically?"
No. I mean it spiritually.
But it is not just what you eat,
but more importantly, how you eat."
I mumbled encouragingly through my crumbs for him to continue.
"You pay attention. You add a little salt. You think about what you're eating. You see what I mean?"
Magali chimed in.
"Yes, because there are people who eat just to supply themselves with nourishment."
Michelle interjected.
"To fill themselves up?"
"They pay absolutely no attention. They eat anything."
"The consciousness disabled," Michelle snorted.
"Do you mean buffet?" I was proud to use this newly learned word. "Eating like an animal?"
"Voila."
He took out his tobacco pouch and began rolling a cigarette. "A lot of Americans eat like that," I said, thinking of my own guilt in that regard.
"Yes, and that's why you have the problem of obesity in America. C'est dramatique, and it's beginning to appear in France. At the school, you see this kind of espèce de merde of chocolate bar."
Magali inserted.
"McDo, too, with all the sugary drinks."
She was talking about McDonald's. I shook my head sadly. I was thinking yesterday that here in France, people have it so good. The food, the good company around the table. Why do they want to do things the American way, especially the worst of it?
"Well, it's very easily explained," Michelle told me. "It's because America is a myth, the American dream."
"All the young people dream of going to America."
"Of course," Michelle exclaimed with sarcastic levity. "All the children of the middle and upper classes want to take a tour of America. It's a must."
He pulled on his cigarette and blew an exasperated smoke ring into the air.
"Well, they also go to learn the language."
"They could go to England for that," I commented. Now Michelle laughed scornfully.
"It's the same thing. In England, they eat like pigs."
He tipped his chair dangerously back and puffed another smoke ring.
"Yeah, fish and chips," I joined him in derision. "Oh."
He brought the chair's front legs down with a thud.
"Now that's fantastique. The fish and chips are fantastic."
The mood became suddenly giddy. Magali waxed positively rhapsodic on American fare.
"And you know, the hamburger and the hot dogs with sauerkraut and mustard, oh la la, that's also really good, from time to time."
Michelle looked at me and shrugged his shoulders.
"You see, in France, they cannot resist it. They love the hamburgers at McDonald's, and the French sandwiches totally lack imagination. It's always ham with butter, ham with butter."
His lips pursed a disdainful grimace.
"You can't find a good sandwich here. It is not possible."
And so, sated with good food and conversation, and buoyed by the leaven of internationalist goodwill, we concluded our repast. Like a fine meal, Michelle's lessons in the French art of gourmandise require time to savor and digest. I've come back to them again and again, catching myself wolfing down my fare, already living in the next instead of the present moment, or stuffing myself with an over-large portion set in front of me, ensnared in the illusion that quantity is equivalent to quality. Then I imagine Michelle looking at me from under his beetle brows with an expression of amused remonstrance, and I slow down to taste what I'm taking in.
À 18 ans, j'ai quitté ma province, bien décidé à empoigner la vie. Le cœur léger et le bagage mince, j'étais certain de conquérir Paris. Chez le tailleur le plus chic, j'ai fait faire ce complet bleu qui était du dernier cri. Les photos, les chansons et les orchestrations ont eu raison de mes économies. Je me voyais déjà en haut de l'affiche, en 10 fois plus gros que n'importe qui, mon nom s'étalait. Je me voyais déjà adulé et riche, signant mes photos aux admirateurs qui se bousculaient. J'étais le plus grand des grands fantaisistes, faisant un succès si fort que les gens m'acclamaient debout. Je me voyais déjà cherchant dans ma liste celle qui le soir pourrait par faveur se prendre à mon cou.
When Thanksgiving rolls around, Native American storyteller and historian Marge Bruchac gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchac co-authored the book, 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We continue our annual tradition of airing Bruchac's true story of Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called first Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that that was the first successful harvest they had had, and being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
to invite
the Indians?
Well, they didn't. That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who, remember, had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out, and they hunt 4 deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food.
You mean with the fish.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? Have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family. That forgets the fact that this is native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine, and he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast, have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchac is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together, and she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister, and she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, "Oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you." And she says, "No, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you." And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields and they pile the earth over it and they watch and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, "Bemkikta, kikta, olioni," to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawez, Yanigawez, Yanigawez. Yanigawez, Yanigawez, Yanigawez. Hola, lique, que, one nail. 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 Hola, lique, que, one nail.
Marge Bruschak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. In addition to 1621, she's the author of other books, including the children's book Malian Song. She's also a performer of Algonquian Indian music and oral traditions. Let's hear a song by Marge Bruschak from her album Voices in the Woods, Abenaki Indian Songs and Stories. The song is called Mothers.
The mothers brought us into this earth, brought us into this earth. The mothers gave us life and birth. Life and birth, the mothers teach us what they know, what they know. The mothers will watch us grow. All the four-legged ones will watch us grow. Watch us grow. All the mothers will watch us grow.
Marge Bruschak singing Mothers on her album Voices in the Woods.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.